No matter what kind of enterprise you are, you'll never be done building Customer 360, and you'll never be done like cleaning up your data, right? So the folks that are waiting for like a true clean Customer 360 are going to keep waiting forever. And if you ask yourself right now, marketers are getting work done, right? So someone is giving them a CSV that might be imperfect, but the work is getting done. So somewhere in the company, there's a lack of fear and a willingness to get shit done even without clean data. And so my take, and I think a lot of the people that choose to work with us, their take is let's do this iteratively. Let's start with the thing that we know for sure. So we know for sure that email addresses are fairly canonical, and that these order IDs correspond. So let's start with this, and over time we'll add more. So this is going to get the marketers off the ground. They can at least do some work. Eventually we'll add mobile app tracking. We'll eventually add like EU and so on, but like let's start iteratively.
Hello, and welcome to Coffee with Coalesce, a monthly podcast about all things data and the trends in technology transforming our industry. I'm Armand Petrosian, CEO of Coalesce, and here with me is my co-founder and CTO, Satish Jayanthi. Together, we'll be your host for the next hour.
I think the music's going to... Oh, we're just going straight into it. We didn't get any music this time. This is a very special.
That sounds good to me.
You get a little bit of like jazz music to ease into it. We're just going straight into it. One of our guests is in the car. I'm sure you could guess who. There'll be people that start to trickle in here as we go. So it's all good. As you get to the office, Kashish, we'll get this rolling more deeply as people get connected here. Feel free to comment in the comment section. Let us know where you're tuning in from. Usually we've got a global audience. It's always nice to see where people are from. And as always, feel free to ask any questions for any of the audience members, for any of us that you're curious about anytime we go through this. But without further ado, let's get rolling. We got an awesome guest today. And I'll let you introduce yourself, Kashish. But I'm pumped for this session. Why don't you hop in, introduce yourself. We, Satish and I can introduce ourselves and we'll get rolling.
Sounds great. Yeah, Satish, Armand, great to hang out. I'm Kashish Gupta, one of the co-founders and co-CEOs of HiTouch. We've been working on this business now for several years and it's just been a lot of fun. We help companies use their data to power their go-to-market stack, usually for marketing. And so a lot of really large marketing teams like PetSmart, GameStop, like Spotify, they rely on us for their marketers to be able to log in, access their data, and run marketing campaigns on their data. So it's just been a lot of fun to work on this business. We started off with a smaller concept called Reverse ETL and have now grown into something much bigger, which is like a marketing platform. And all three of us as co-founders are really like engineers with a more back-end type of background.
Yep.
And so we're really looking forward to talking to you guys about transformation and about how some of these larger enterprises think about giving access to data.
Love it. Awesome. I got more questions before I jump into them. Satish, why don't you introduce yourself and I'll do myself as well. We can jump in.
Sure. I am Satish Jayanthi, co-founder, CTO of Coalesce. Worked with Armand on this for about 3.5 years now on this business. My background is primarily technical and built a lot of data warehouses and for larger companies in the past. And all that experience and all the pain that I and my colleagues experienced, we bring that into the implementation of our tool today.
Cool. And as the host here, I'm the CEO, Coalesce, co-founder with Satish. We worked together for a long time. I'll save everybody on my background and focus more on our guest here, Kashish. I've got a quick question for you. You mentioned that you went through the process of starting out as a reverse ETL company into more marketing intelligence. Can you just talk through the founding story for yourself and like how you even got to this point? I can't remember. How long did you say that you guys have been running this company?
Since 2020.
Okay.
So our company, it's really founded by listening to customers. I know it sounds like a cliche, but we had the wrong idea several times until customers told us exactly what they wanted and told us that they had better ideas for us. So in the early days, what happened is that we told ourselves, hey, look, folks that are doing go-to-market, sales, customer support, customer success, all of them are flying blind. They don't know what the customer is doing in their product. They don't know what the usage metrics are, but they're still getting on these calls and trying to run these sales calls. So we wanted to get customer information in front of those users. And usually that information was sitting with the data team, mm-hmm. usually in something like BI. So our thought process was, all right, we're going to build them some sort of layer on top of the data warehouse. It's going to allow you to transactionally store and transactionally query the data on the data warehouse. And it's going to let you then be able to pull up that data in real time and understand your customer. Every single one of those users said, I don't want another dashboarding tool. I want this data in Salesforce or in Marketo or Salesforce Marketing Cloud, whatever you might have. And then we built a point and click UI to be able to accomplish that. And then again, they said, hey, why can't you just give me a text box where I can write my SQL query? So at every step of the way, they really said, hey, like, how about you give me something else different than what you're giving me right now? And that'll actually make me more successful in your product. And so we, us three together, kind of like, it was just us three and one more engineer. It was four of us building these products one by one and iterating on them based on what customers wanted. Up until we finally had the kind of SQL text box, you can map the columns to the columns in your SAS tools. And that's when we started calling it reverse ETL.
Okay. Got it. And then you talk about it shifting from reverse ETL to what it is today, or would you still consider it reverse ETL? It's just evolved.
It's just evolved because the syncing engine is still the same, right? So you still need to get queries from the data warehouse into your SaaS products. So the underlying layer is actually the exact same, but how you access that layer, whether it's a SQL query or some other point and click UI, has changed. And that's really the core difference. Just, I guess, a little bit more. So Tatis, Josh, and I have been working together for a long time. We used to live together in kind of a weird 10-bedroom house in the Mission. And Tatis and I were working on a company together. Josh was working on a company. COVID happened, and both of the companies were pivoting at the same time. And so we actually merged two different startups together to start Hightouch. And it was probably like the best decision in our lives, just because we would not be here today if we had not done that. And so happy to chat more about kind of how we met as well. That's interesting.
Wait, so it was a 10-bedroom house. You three lived in that house. Was it more like a startup house, or like, I mean, were all those bedrooms being used? What was the deal there?
At any given time, there's probably like 12 or so people that live there. And so it was just a large group house with a bunch of friends, maybe 50% founders, and always a lot of debauchery going on.
Got it. And then what were the two companies that were separate that merged together?
Yeah, so Tatis and I were working on a travel AI company. Think about it as GPT, but for booking your travel over Slack.
Okay.
And then Josh was working on an IoT deployment company. So he would help people deploy firmware and software updates to their ARM devices.
Okay, got it. And then both of you decided for whatever reason, hey, let's go into reverse ETL from that?
It was an iterative process. Yeah, we kind of pivoted to customer success, then dashboarding, and then finally over to the data space. And it really was, we always had intention to build things for go-to-market folks. So we always thought we were going to build a product for kind of sales ops, marketing ops, marketers. But every single one of those folks we talked to said, hey, go show this to my data person. My data person's going to get way more excited.
Yeah.
And so we accidentally found ourselves in the data space, and we're really glad that we did.
And you guys had been in it before, right? I mean, a lot of the background was at Segment. So this isn't like completely new, although it wasn't intention to start.
Exactly. So Tatis and Josh, actually, they built the marketing platform piece of Segment, as well as other parts of Segment as well. So I would call that like very squarely in the MarTech space. And some people will call that in the data space as well. And so the cool thing is that a lot of what they had built there, we were solving the exact same problem, but with a fundamentally different architecture. So they were able to skip all of the thinking on like, what should this accomplish? What are users going to say? What feedback are they going to have for us? But just completely re-architected on top of the data warehouse.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, I always have a lot of admiration and respect for founders who go through a portion of the journey that you went through as you look to find product market fit, work with customers, go through iterations. Like, both Satish and I would say have been spoiled, because from our past life, we were exposed to the audience we work with. We were exposed to the problem that we solve over and over and over again at a scale that I think gave us a pretty unique vantage point. Whereas going through the journey that you've gone through, it really has been like an iterative, longstanding journey. Obviously, getting to a really great destination, but I would imagine just takes a ton of discipline and a ton of conversations too. So,
exactly. And I'm happy to actually dig into kind of like what it takes to re-architect something like Segment on the data warehouse, because it is quite interesting. When you rely on someone else's database to basically be the back,
there's a lot of trade-offs that you have to make.
So can you jump into this, Kashish, a little bit more about like you guys re-architecting, but also just explaining, you use the term composable CDP all the time in your marketing. Like, what does that actually mean, and how are they interrelated, if at all?
Yes. Yeah, so fundamentally what changed is that we decided a CDP should not store your data. So customer data platform is something that has been done maybe like 20 or 30 times by different companies. All of them say, hey, forward me all your data in the format of events, and I'll store it for you, and I'll house your data for you. In the enterprise, that doesn't make any sense, because they say, hey, I have a data warehouse. I don't want to forward you my data. I already have my data in a customer data platform. And so we call Snowflake, Databricks, BigQuery, the data warehouse you already have, we call that a customer data platform. And the thing that's missing there is a UI that business users can operate on.
Right.
So they can't log in and access the data in Snowflake today. We give them that UI. And what we do in order to power that UI is we also provide them a semantic layer. Without that semantic layer, that UI would be pretty meaningless. It would just have SQL commands that they wouldn't really understand. But because we're able to provide kind of a connection to your existing database, a semantic layer, and then an audience segmentation and analytics layer on top of that, that's really what powers the ability for these teams to use Snowflake as their customer data platform. And none of those data teams want to build marketer UIs in-house. Right. So you ask them, they'll say, of course, I want to do transformation in-house. On Coalesce, of course, I want to do things like orchestration, but I certainly don't want to build UIs from a marketing team.
Yeah.
And we see companies like Walmart building these in-house, but pretty much every single other company says, I would love to delegate this to Hightouch.
Right. And historically, they would go, like a marketing team would have to go and buy a separate CDP related product that didn't have anything to do with the cloud data warehouse, right? Like, this is basically a way to circumvent a historical legacy architecture and just leverage the existing data warehouse as the CDP.
So think of the original architecture as entirely based on event tagging. So you have something like Google Tag Manager or other event taggers on your website. Okay. And it relies solely on those to bring the data into the CDP. Okay. So I think it's just a difference between kind of, A, like those products were built for smaller companies that could rely on just digital events.
Right.
B, it was built on a previous architecture when events were getting exciting. Like Amplitude and Mixpanel were getting exciting. Folks wanted to do all their product analytics through those kinds of events, but they were ignoring server side, and they were ignoring things like point of sale, brick and mortar, and all the other type of like asynchronous ways like things could change. And like a really good example of this that we learned in the early days is financial services. They really can't rely on web events. And the reason for that is because it takes several days for the payment to clear from your bank account. And then another 30 to 60 days before the credit card company will say that this is officially settled and cannot be refunded. Right. So there's all these asynchronous things that happen that can only really be tracked in something like a data warehouse. Through some sort of like client-side event collection, it wouldn't really make any sense.
And that's purely because it's actually in real time versus it having to be processed over the course of those 30 to 60 days.
Right. Where like the e-commerce experience might be real time, but then those things that are processed asynchronously, they have to be stored in something that has that has state and can actually like maintain state.
So originally, and this is me being completely transparent, as I saw Hightouch and the reverse ETL market emerge, my interpretation was similar to like a Fivetran, loading data from many different sources into one target platform. Reverse ETL was going to take it from that target platform and basically reverse ingest it back to the source systems. And it was going to be a broad amount of source systems, like whatever it may be, Workday, Salesforce, Marketo, like you mentioned, but a really, really broad amount of sources. Sounds like you're focused more on fewer sources, but really delivering to those core audiences within those sources. Is that fair to say?
It's so many things now for different companies. I think fundamentally, like, here's how we think about it. Every company at scale wants to use data to improve their marketing. If they can do that, they can make more money. It's really simple, right? So if you can personalize your campaigns, if you can send the right product offer to the right customer at the right time, you can do a lot more with your data and make a lot more money. So that's fundamentally what we're providing. Sometimes that's in the format of SQL queries piped to your ad platforms. Other times it's a segmentation builder for your marketers. And very soon we're also providing the ability to use AI to be able to power some of these workflows as well. That way it can iteratively decide what message and what time to send the message to the customer.
Got it.
So there's some things that like Databricks does a really good job at, for example. They have this thing called Next Best Offer. And it's a very simple like piece of data science that chooses what offer to show the customer next. That has, and it's a cross product between like kind of highest value for the business as well as highest propensity for the person to buy.
This would be like an example when you're on Amazon and you see like,
exactly,
also bought this, and this when you're buying a specific item.
Exactly. It could be a time of checkout. It could be just in the sidebar. Amazon.com is like probably the best known at doing this well.
Right.
And this is something that like smaller companies would love to have. It would increase their conversion and it would increase probably LTV for their customers because they'd buy more and more things. So that's the kind of use case that we're working on with a lot of our e-commerce customers or like brick and mortar customers. And they're oftentimes telling us too that they're not able to look at the browsing history of that user across mobile and web. And that's again where the data warehouse and like a really good transformation and like a canonical model comes into place. Because if you know what that person's shopping for on web and mobile and it's combined into one user ID, then you can do a much better job of targeting that user with their next product.
Yeah, I mean, I was saving this for near the end. We can jump back to this piece in a second. I've got a different question. I mean, obviously where the data foundation is and what Hightouch is pulling from is going to be critical to the success of the customer. But you did touch on something that I'm curious to get your stance on. You brought up the concept of a semantic layer and Hightouch and the importance of it. I think we've heard a ton about semantic layers these past couple years. It hasn't really seemed to pan out as a direct concept, or at least not something that people are particularly focused on. As far as we're concerned, like, we talked to so many different customers and it hasn't really been something that's taken off the way that I think some vendors have said that it would or had promised it would. Yep. And so I'm curious, what's your stance on it?
Yeah. So, I could not agree with you more. It's undoubtable. It's undoubtable that LookML is like the only really used semantic layer today.
Yeah.
And past that, there's not really any others. I would say Hightouch is actually the second most used semantic layer. And the reason for it is actually because no one really realizes it's a semantic layer or calls it one. So why do we have a semantic layer, right? It's not just because we want to have one. It's because ideally it should have some end purpose. And in this case, that end purpose should be that maybe there's so many dimensions on users that we can't actually flatten that into one table. We need to give the marketing team the ability to query by different dimensions at different times. And certain teams have access to certain dimensions, other teams have access to different dimensions. Mm-hmm. So you might have, for example, one of our customers is like the largest hotel chain in Europe. They have different users in different geographies, and only the right geographical marketing team should be able to access the right person. So semantic layer includes governance. It includes the ability to query by certain dimensions at a certain time without flattening tables completely, right? So that's like kind of the baseline for us. The way ours works is it's simply just a layer that the data team sets up in order to power the rest of our product. So if you want to do audience segmentation in Hightouch, or if you want to do analytics in Hightouch, as long as you have the semantic layer set up, Hightouch will adapt to your data model rather than you having to transform your data into something that Hightouch understands. which no SaaS tool has ever done before. Every single SaaS tool says, get the data in this exact format that I'm describing to you. And once you do so, things will work nicely, which is a shit ton of work for the data team. And so let me just quickly show you if this works. All right, so you can see this.
Can't see anything yet.
All right, if it doesn't work, then I'll just let it go. Okay, well, so basically what you can imagine is all we're doing is we're allowing the data team to describe join columns between different tables in their data warehouse.
Okay.
So for example, you could have orders are joined on users, so people can buy things. Then users can be in households. So you could have a user set that is all in one house. And then households can have subscriptions. So instead of the subscription being on the user object, in this business model, call it Instacart, subscriptions are not on the user object, they're on the household object. And users inherit their subscription from a household. And then each user individually can make orders, but then households inherit the subscriptions, the orders from all the users. Right? So this is not that complex of a data model, but it's completely different from a typical e-commerce data model. And you as a marketer, if you wanted to target all households that have spent more than $1,000 a month, you wouldn't be able to do that in any CRM in the world today, because they would not help you aggregate on a household basis. They'd only help you aggregate on a user basis. And then you have to find some other funky way to aggregate on a household basis.
Are you typically building one semantic layer or multiple semantic layers based on your need?
So think of it as each customer's semantic layer will look completely different from the next. And sometimes within the customer, it will be disjoint. You're right. So DoorDash might have like a B2B part of their business and then B2C part of their business, hypothetical example. But they have to market towards like restaurants and they have to market towards their end customers. Different data model entirely, and different marketing team, maybe even different BU entirely. And we see this for like, I'm sure like y'all see this as well, but like a lot of our customers are multi-brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so like Warner Music, for example, they do art, they do advertising and like concert tickets for about 4,000 artists. And so they might have like a different layer for a set of artists. Like each label might have their own representation.
One more question on that. So how much transformation happens in these semantic layers typically?
For us, it's all virtualized. Yeah. So it's nothing is written back to the data warehouse. We do some light caching in order to be able to sample the data and be able to tell you what you're going to get before you get it. But it's a really good question. And like, would love to get your take, because we have considered writing some of these tables back to the warehouse, and some of our customers have asked us for it. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, we don't want to be that layer that creates like canonical models.
What are your thoughts on that, Satish? I mean, do you see why that makes more sense, or any other thoughts on the general approach?
I mean, overall, you know, the idea here is, hey, you got this data warehouse that's doing a lot of stuff in terms of transformation, preparing the data. And then how do you take advantage of that information in the way that Hightouch is taking? That makes complete sense to me. And how they're pushing that information back to the right spots. Otherwise, people rely on these dashboards. And you have tons and tons of these dashboards. And it's really hard to actually use them for decision making. In this case, if you push that data to the right spots, it's also available in your operational flow right away. So,
There's some more interesting examples here. Like, where do you want to push the data, right? Let's say you want to push the data to an email CRM. Mm-hmm. No email CRM right now has the concept of a household. They don't have the concept of a parent and a child. They don't have the concept of a pet owner and a pet. And so if you want to actually forward your data model to one of these email CRMs, it's not possible unless you have a B2B CRM like a Marketo. Then you do have the concept of a business with users underneath. So this hierarchical data actually can't be forwarded as is. There needs to be some meta layer above the email CRM that orchestrates. And so, for example, Armand would say, all right, I want to query for every pet owner where their pet birthday is in the next month. Right. So we're not looking at user birthdays. The email CRM only has user birthdays. Each user might have multiple pets, and any of those pets might have a birthday within the next 30 days. That's exactly what PetSmart's use case is. And they couldn't accomplish that use case in any CRM that they could buy on the market today. And so they need a hierarchy where a user can have multiple pets and where the pets have their own birthdays. And you can query by the pet birthdays in aggregate rather than just the user birthdays. And so that's where like a semantic layer is extremely helpful, because you can be able to just, you can describe, all right, well, we have a pets table, a users table, they're joined on this column. And now I can run queries in either direction. I can look up all dog owners, or I could look up all people that have dog birthdays in the next 30 days.
Yeah, I see. And because this information is already accessible within the cloud data warehouse, whatever it may be, you're basically applying, you're basically pulling from that as the source. And then you have an interface on top of it that is more approachable for somebody who that's relevant with in the marketing department, for example.
Exactly. And like, we don't make claims that we can do a better job of this for really simple businesses like Shopify stores.
Right.
Like your Shopify store, like your data model is pretty simple and pretty standard. Yeah. But as soon as you now want to query by like, which of my stores are performing better, let me go run advertising in those zip codes. As soon as you have questions like those, you can't answer those really in any tool today other than BI. And in order to answer those tools in BI, those questions in BI, you need a pretty sophisticated person to ask those questions and answer them.
Right.
That's where we get super excited, because we built a semantic layer only because we had to.
Yeah.
Only because each of our customers were so special and so different that their data models could not be transformed into the standard format. So. Right. In the very, very early days, we made this trade-off. We said, hey, look, like, we're going to make the semantic layer really early on. Our UI is going to be completely different for every customer that logs in. As a result, we're an enterprise company. We're not going to be doing this for SMBs.
Right.
And it's probably going to break a lot. But it didn't. Like, we actually somehow, we kind of got away with being able to rely on the semantic layer and a really consistent SQL data warehouse underneath to be able to run these queries pretty safely. And it's all templating. So we basically, like, our segmentation builder compiles onto JSON. That JSON converts into the SQL format of the data warehouse. So it's slightly different for BigQuery versus Redshift and so on. And then that query runs safely on the data warehouse. And if it doesn't, then we'll show you the error of what the data warehouse is spitting out, and we'll be able to tell you why that query didn't work.
So you mentioned that it worked out better than you had anticipated. You thought it was going to break a lot, didn't. I'm sure you got some great engineers that helped make that happen. What were some of the challenges throughout this journey outside of, I mean, you described how iterative it was, but like, what are either some of the challenges going through this, or even some of the challenges today that you see for teams or users of high touch, not necessarily when it comes to high touch, but just in general, like implementing or having success with data operations?
So much of it is kind of like, how do you streamline engineering so that you don't dig yourself into a hole?
Okay.
I don't mean that in a negative way, but like, look at every company that's ever built integrations. How many of their engineers are building more integrations and maintaining them versus like building new products and surface area for business users? You would think that the majority of our company is building integrations because we have over 200 of them. But in the early days, we actually made like really cool trade-offs where we said, hey, look, we're going to build a templating language, our own internal templating language, and it's going to auto-generate the UI for all of our integrations. So none of our integrations team, outside of like maybe 5% of integrations, actually works on the customer-facing UI for these integrations. You basically fill in like 4 to 5 function headers, one for auth, one for create, one for update, et cetera, and then the UI generates itself. So there's optimizations like those that really cut out like 50% of your engineering time.
Nice.
There's a lot of sync level infrastructure that works across many different integrations. So things like retries, dead letter queue, you get kind of for free as an integration engineer. That's maintained by a different team. And so we kind of architected the system in the way that we knew we would need it at scale, and then just built it from that way on day one. And we didn't have to worry about things like horizontal scaling until quite a bit later, but it was really easy to set up because we were already containerized.
Right.
So I mean, these are like really small things on the engineering side, but they add up. And if we didn't have those decisions in the early days, right now I would say like maybe like at any given time out of like 35 engineers, maybe one or two of them are working on maintaining existing code and bug fixes.
Got it.
Which I think is pretty rare for a company of our size. So those were on the engineering side. And then on the other side, it's how do you make a trade-off and say, hey, we're not going to serve SMBs, and we're going to build kind of this like larger product, but it's going to work really well for enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we could make that call is because we said, we don't want to be the product that people grow out of.
Yeah.
We want to be the product that every like successful company grows into. And what we were told by many of our mentors was that you can either build a good product for B2B companies or a good product for B2C companies, because B2B data models always look similar to each other, and B2C data models always look similar to each other. So marketing tools can just be one of two types. That was the feedback from the market. And every email CRM will tell you the same thing. Focus on B2C or B2B. We actually fundamentally disagreed with that. And that was another trade-off that we made that that was very controversial in the early days, but I think it was totally correct, because in enterprise, an enterprise B2C model actually always looks like a B2B model in some way or another. Because enterprises can never just have users that click on buttons and buy things. They always are under some brand, under some geography, oftentimes in some grouping. They have subscriptions. So because enterprise B2C becomes multimodal, it ends up looking like a B2B data model. And that's why all of their CRMs break. Does that kind of make sense? I might have gone kind of fast.
It does make sense. It also sounds like for some of the smaller companies, there's already an answer, like you mentioned with Shopify, for example.
Yep.
A pretty simple data model. Doesn't really make sense to try to address a problem there if it's good enough for that period. It does not scale, though. So as you get bigger, as you target a company like a PetSmart, they don't have an answer like that. There isn't one model that they can move it into to get the same results that you're providing. And so that's where something like High Touch would come in. And that's the way that you solve that problem.
Right. And the examples are never ending, right? So like you could have like patients that are correlated to both hospitals as well as doctors.
Right.
You might want to like slice and dice based on that. Like what I'm kind of trying to get at, this becomes super clear in the case of marketing activation, which is what we do.
Yeah.
You want to run a campaign, you want to know everyone who's visited a specific doctor in the last 30 days and then mention that doctor's name in the campaign, right? So that's right. It's super, super clear why this is necessary from an activation perspective. Something that people have been trying to do for 20 years is self-serve analytics.
Right.
And this exact same semantic layer and exact same paradigm for marketers can really enable self-serve analytics. It's kind of like the wrong thing to say, because as soon as you tell someone self-serve analytics, they'll stop believing you. They won't take you as seriously.
Yeah.
We do truly believe that like there's an inflection point now where self-serve analytics is possible for marketers in these kinds of constrained environments where you've given them semantics. So now they can learn everything they want to learn about a user that makes orders within households. And then maybe over time you expose to them more things, but you don't just throw the whole entire kitchen sink, or in this case, the whole data warehouse at them at once. You give them access to certain entities.
That makes sense. So another element to this is it's all with the underlying assumption that single source of truth has been properly persisted. The data has been prepared properly. How often are you seeing that being an issue prior to being able to activate for the marketing team? Like, is that something that comes up often? Where do you see the maturity curve right now with companies? Like, are they still getting there?
It's still pretty early in the maturity curve. There's kind of two ways people go at this.
Yeah.
No matter what kind of enterprise you are, you'll never be done building customer 360.
Right.
And you'll never be done like cleaning up your data. Right. So the folks that are waiting for like a true clean customer 360, are going to keep waiting forever. If you ask yourself right now, marketers are getting work done, right? So someone is giving them a CSV that might be imperfect, but the work is getting done. So somewhere in the company, there's a lack of fear and a willingness to get shit done even without clean data. So my take, and I think a lot of the people that choose to work with us, their take is, let's do this iteratively.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the thing that we know for sure. So we know for sure that email addresses are fairly canonical, and that these order IDs correspond. So let's start with this, and over time we'll add more. So this is gonna get the marketers off the ground. They can at least do some work. Eventually we'll add mobile app tracking. We'll eventually add like EU and so on, but like let's start iteratively. And because, and oftentimes what we'll see is they'll have a digital arm within a larger company. So you're seeing the rise of like chief digital officers, where you might have in a retail company or in a media company, someone that runs kind of the digital arm of the company. And those are usually the folks that want to get off the ground first and have better data. So the streaming arm of a larger media company oftentimes is going to be the first mover. They'll get started, and then over time, they'll bring on other business units.
Makes sense. So this wouldn't be a Coffee with Coalesce at this point if we didn't ask something about AI or ML related stuff. So you're already making it, like with the product, it's for a less technical user. You're simplifying it a bunch so that way they can access something that they typically wouldn't be able to, or perhaps they wouldn't be able to use a dashboard to analyze data. So how do you see, you mentioned a little bit at the beginning, but how do you see high touch unlocking some level of AI functionality for your customers?
Yeah, so this is like one of those like hold my drink moments, because next week there will be something pretty exciting here that we're going to be sharing publicly.
Okay.
But what you can imagine is one of two things. So one is everyone's always promised that I'll tell you what's working and what's not working in your marketing. So every marketing tool, whether it's an email tool, ad tool, a CDP like us, they'll always say, we can tell you what works, and that way you can do that thing more. Or what doesn't work, then you can do that thing less.
Right.
No one's actually been able to deliver this. What we're fairly certain that we'll be able to deliver this now. And a large reason for that is because of AI. And it's not AI. So what really bothers me right now is that a lot of folks think that AI is synonymous with generative AI and it's synonymous with like chat-based interfaces. So my co-founders and I have this like, kind of wording internally where we call like chat AI one thing, and then like AI completely separate. Like there's like not distinct, but like AI is a superset of chat AI. Chat AI is just GPT type stuff. But then there's actually data science, which is actually still really useful. And it can get you really far in terms of being able to tell marketers what's working and what's not working. So what's the prereq? The prereq is you need data. So we're partnering with Fivetran to get data in to the data warehouse.
Nice.
And then you need some sort of standard model, some sort of like analytics UI on top in order to be able to share that data with the marketer.
Right.
And so what you'll see pretty soon is the ability for the marketer to ask questions and learn what's working, what's not working. And they can be abstract even outside of the campaigns they've already run. So a lot of marketing tools will say, I'll give you analytics on the campaigns you run inside my tool, not analytics outside of what you do in my tool. So it's really just analytics on like Salesforce. It's not analytics on your entire marketing.
Right, right.
We're basically saying, as long as you include that data within our semantic layer, we will give you analytics on top of that data entirely. And so you could ask, you might be like a one medical type of business. You could ask what doctors are billing the most.
Right.
And then you could say, I need to now do more marketing in those zip codes or less or something, right? So you could ask like completely abstract questions and get insight and then change your marketing. That's step one. So step one is just insight. And then step two is actually much more exciting because it closes the feedback loop. So it says now we're actually going to use Gen AI and actually take those insights and through some approach, we will be able to feed forward those insights into actually changing your marketing campaigns. So the system should learn what time of day the customer responds, what offers the customer is more highest propensity to buy. And it should be able to then show those offers to the customer to get them some end outcome.
Got it.
And so here what I'll share is, do you kind of know like what like journey builders are, like journey orchestration? So journey orchestration is like some sort of DAG. It'll say like, send the customer an email. If they don't respond in 24 hours, then do this.
Right. And
if they don't respond in 36 hours, do something else. It's like very linear.
Some sequence basically of it's like a tree chart or whatever.
Right. So those sequences are always a sub-optimization based on what humans can describe to a computer.
Right.
So we as human beings can only describe like a few linear paths to a computer and tell the computer, all right, go do these things. But it's never going to be comprehensive, and it's always going to be guesswork.
Right.
So why not instead give the computer a state that says, all right, customer can end up in one of these five states, and help me figure out which of the states to optimize and what to show the customer on the path there. So it's a bit more far-fetched. There's like iterative ways to get there that are actually like really practical today. But that's where we see the world going. We see the world going towards something where marketers continue to write copy, actually. So this might be controversial because everyone wants GPT to write copy. But I think marketers will continue to write copy and make creative, but computer systems will actually optimize what campaign to show the customer at what time.
That makes sense. I mean, from a high level, it sounds like high touch is basically giving the users a way more holistic view of what they're trying to accomplish versus it being all so specific to one marketing platform, purely because it's from the consolidated data set from every source. Like you mentioned earlier around, like your previous marketing technology would only give you the results or the advice as to what's working and what's not working that's relative to that specific product. Whereas with high touch, you're looking at something that's touching every part of the business,
right. And
it has a much more holistic view of the data, the information as to what's working in a broader perspective.
Right. And a lot of the CMOs we talk to, they'll say, hey, look, my email team knows what emails people are clicking on. Like, we would not be a good email team if we didn't have that insight.
Sure.
We have no idea what they're shopping on after they get to the website. And we have no idea what kind of advertising they're engaging with.
Right.
And if we have a full view, then I could actually send better emails to that same person because I know what they shopped for 24 hours, 36 hours later after clicking the email. And so it's like really simple stuff, like stuff that you would never expect to not have. But
yeah.
In the enterprise, it's really tough to combine all those data models. And they might have different data teams reporting to each of those lifecycle marketing and advertising teams. So there's like a product analytics team, there's a lifecycle analytics team, and then there's an advertising analytics team. And they don't talk to each other either. They might be sitting in different offices.
Yeah. I mean, there would just be like handoffs basically of like, okay, so they click the email, then what? Some other team has a journey of that, but they're not communicating with the original team. And then there's some post-sales journey as well. So you bring that all together under one pane of glass, basically.
Yep.
Okay. Super helpful. I got one last question for you. And this is again, a bit more broad. Like when you look at the analytics industry, when you look at what's going on with the platform players, even with high touch, like, what is something that you continue to be most excited about when it comes to the industry as a whole?
I mean, I don't know if this is a cop-out answer, but the data warehouses are going real time, like in a very serious way. And that really excites us. Like even like just dynamic tables is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
But there's quite a few other features that we're like collaborating with them on that makes it easier to imagine doing these like real-time activities together, right? So again, like we fundamentally rely on data warehouses as the data layer. We don't store any of the data. And so if those layers can't be real-time, we can't provide real-time well.
Right.
We can provide it in hacky ways, honestly, but not in the same way as if we were just to store everything in a transactional database, for example. And so as they get more real-time, as you're able to stream data in and out of them, it gets pretty exciting. And you could like incrementally compute what you want to show the next customer, right? Or you could host a machine learning model that would hit the data warehouse every time rather than hitting our servers every time. And it could incrementally, like every hour, every day, it could batch process, retrain, and then predict in milliseconds every single query, right? So there's like really interesting things that can happen once the data layer gets more and more powerful, especially from an ML perspective and a real-time perspective. And we do see that happening. So we work like really closely with GCP, Databricks, and Snowflake. And so they're pretty good about sharing their roadmap and getting us beta access. And Josh, our CTO, would never, like kind of similar to how we made the right decisions early days, he wouldn't be relying on those vendors unless he had conviction that they'd actually get there.
Right.
And to be honest, like we didn't think Snowflake would ship container services this early on. We didn't think Snowflake would have like dynamic tables this early on.
Yeah.
And we're pretty happy with how quickly they've been able to move as a large company.
Yeah, agreed. It's awesome. I love the concept of real time. And I'm sure for you as a company that's activating marketing teams, there's so many different ways that you can leverage real-time information to do really cool stuff. Is there a specific use case that would be most exciting for you to be able to bring to life for a customer when it comes to real-time activation?
Yeah, so the thing about real-time is that only like really 5% of customers need it 5% of the time.
For sure, yeah.
The most interesting one I've heard so far is recommendations at time of checkout.
Okay.
So it'll be something like, I'm buying a gaming PC. can you recommend me a gaming mouse and a gaming keyboard? Mm-hmm. And then if you want to take it one level deeper, again, we're not going to go in this direction, but one level deeper would be, can you allow advertisers to bid at time of checkout based on intent? So at the time of checkout, NVIDIA would bid way higher for a GPU if you're buying like a gaming rig,
right, than
when you're not at time of checkout, because they know you're so high intent at that point.
Yep.
Right? So you could actually create like a bidding server at time of checkout based on the customer's intent. And mm-hmm. at that time, you want to know everything they've shopped from the last 5 minutes and clicked on, mm-hmm. as well as what's in their cart right now. So that's where it gets like pretty intense, and real time gets really useful.
Yeah.
And I think like, I think there's some client side things that we can do there to get off the ground.
This is awesome. This has been super helpful, Cash. I've really enjoyed hearing not just the journey, but also the direction you're headed in, particularly for customers. So yeah, it's been a blast. Thanks for having, thanks for coming on.
Of course. Yeah.
Thanks, Cash.
Thanks, Satish.
Yeah.
And I hope you guys have a great rest of your Thursday.
All righty, you too.
For anybody that's coming from somewhere else. Sweet.